the Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of the Bionics Studio. Listening, watching, reacting to and learning from every spoken word, caller, tweet and SMS to unmix, unlock and understand your content. The Bionics Studio transforms everything about radio except the way you make it.
Hello and welcome back to the Radio Today podcast with me, your guest host for the week, James Brown. My guest this week is journalist, broadcaster and creative director of the independent production company Made in Manchester, or MIM for short. Ashley Byrne is here. Hello.
Hello, James. You okay?
You know what? I'm super good, thanks. I'm thrilled to be hosting this podcast and to be speaking to you. And I'm really looking forward to discussing the week that we've all had as a nation and as an industry. And so I thought I'd start by asking what it's been like for you as the owner of a production company in the wake of the sad news of the passing of the Duke of Edinburgh.
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult as a small independent production company, although we're growing all the time. But, you know, we've always in our 16 years had to juggle lots of plates and do lots of things. And that's the nature of the business, and it's the nature of the industry, really, because no secret, really, that budgets in radio are not like budgets in television. So, you know, you've always got to keep your ear out for work, and you've always got to make sure that you're delivering properly and you're delivering a good product and, you know, stuff that is really good quality and that the commissioners will keep coming back to you for. And, you know, we've been doing it now for 16 years, and I have to say, yeah, recently it's probably been one of those busy periods we've had for a long time. I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that a lot of things, of course, were cancelled or postponed during the coronavirus period, and therefore broadcasters and others have decided, right, now is the time to bring things back on board again. And of course it all happens at once, and you've got to meet the challenge, kind of thing. So yeah, it has been busy. We've been very, very pressed on quite a few things, but the great thing about broadcasting and the great thing about what we do as a production company, as opposed to working in an in-house department at the BBC or at some other big company, is that we have such a variety of things to do. So at the moment, everything from producing documentaries that we've just done about Prince Philip, to a big 10-part jazz series, to an investigative doc in Japan, through to a history series about the history of the human body with Alice Roberts. And then, of course, just before that, we had our new comedy series, The Likely Dads, as well, which is 8 parts. So, yeah, it's been a very, very busy period, and we've still got quite a lot coming up, which is great. But at the same time as doing all that, doing the work, you've got to constantly keep thinking about ideas as well. And ideas are our currency. We're only as good as the last thing we came up with, really. So, but it's always been like that. You know, that's the nature of independent production, really, in a way.
I wanted to ask you about what it's been like managing people, managing the company, and as you say, you know, keeping those ideas coming in when at times it's all sort of been up against us, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard. It's very difficult just keeping all the plates spinning because, you know, as I said before, the budgets are very pretty small that you're dealing with on a regular basis. So, but, you know, you've got to make sure that the team that you have on board, you know, are dedicated, are happy, and you've got to be aware that people will put in extra hours and extra time, including myself, and that we need to make sure that they get some quality time as well and space, because at the end of the day, it's really important that people are happy and enjoy their work and enjoy their jobs. I think largely people do, and everybody tends to put in extra 110, 120% when it comes to something that has to be turned around fairly quickly. You know, everybody realised, you know, in the last week or so that we had some Prince Philip docs that we were planning to do, and of course they had to be made fairly quickly. And it was great to see the team of people at Made in Manchester actually get on with that and make sure it happened. You know, it was a task, but I was very proud about what we managed to achieve. You know, we did 2 documentaries, in fact 3 actually, in a way, for the World Service and for 5 Live. They were both angled in different ways, and we had to, you know, drop everything and act very quickly to make them happen. I mean, what was a challenge with that really was that we'd planned these documentaries the day I met. Basically, we do a series of documentaries every now and again for, you know, we've done them on Nelson Mandela, the day I met Nelson Mandela, the day I met Bobby Robson, the day I met Princess Diana. We've done them over the years for mainly for Five Live. And the challenge is keeping them fresh when, in terms of the content, because we plan them for other events generally. And of course, as soon as Prince Philip died, everybody was at the story, and all the various stories are coming out about, you know, different things, anecdotes about his growing up and his early years with the Queen and his involvement with different charities and all those kind of things. And the Duke of Edinburgh Awards was mentioned everywhere. So you're constantly thinking, well, how much have we got in these documentaries that's fresh, and how much extra do we need? So that was a constant challenge because, you know, as you're aware, everybody was at it straight away. I mean, partly the reason for that was because we were in obit period, which is where, you know, a senior member of the royal family dies and broadcasters have to react to that. And therefore, as you're well aware from being a radio person, everyone dreads the obit light going off and having to act on that and whatever. But basically, it means that, you know, there is blanket coverage for a period of time. So, yeah, that was really quite difficult because we didn't know when our programmes were going to go out. We didn't know whether the broadcasters wanted them straight away or they wanted them later in the week. In the end, because they're quite reflective and involved ordinary people and some well-known people as well from different parts of the world generally, they decided to make them specials for the day of the funeral. So we at least had a week to get them, well, more or less a week to get them made. But I've got reservations in a way about the coverage and whatever, and we'll go on to that in a minute if you want. But but yeah, generally it's very good. Great to be part of a big event in a way. I mean, a very sad event, but it was fantastic to be in a situation whereby, you know, the World Service and Five Live on the day of his funeral made something of our documentary. So I'm very proud of what the team managed to turn around in such a short space of time.
And in the end, that work ended up going out in a very prominent spot in the schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the World Service one went out at 4 o'clock directly after the funeral. So that means we were, you know, Made in Manchester was making its mark all around the world at a very important time. And in fact, we got some great feedback. You know, somebody said on Twitter, go to BBC World because, you know, it's a really great programme of people's memories and it's moving and all the rest of it. And far better than the drivel that's being broadcast at the moment on the US TV network. So that was quite nice. So, yeah, no, it's fantastic. I mean, it's largely the programme, the Day I Met series, is people's memories mixed together with archive and not really a presenter. And in this instance, we actually did have a presenter for the BBC World Service with Winifred Robinson. But generally, it's just people's memories and people listening to it. I don't know what you think about when it comes to making radio programmes, but I don't think the audience necessarily know always how much work goes into that. You know, the painstaking work in terms of trying to, you know, piece it all together. There will be situations where you interview somebody and, you know, because there's, again, because it's first person, they're having to do several takes and you're thinking, which take should we use? And editing is an art in itself. I mean, you know this, James. It's very painstaking and it can be quite a lonely business, can't it? Let's face it. Because you've got to make a decision there and then. There are occasions when you can get together as a team and do stuff. But generally, if you're doing something very quick and trying to turn something around, you know, it's all down to you at the end of the day.
I remember it was one of the very first questions about the business I think I ever asked you when I first met you, because I'd only just sort of grasped this whole thing. I didn't understand how you could take that much information, how you could take a 45-minute interview, because I'd tried doing it by trial and error at that point. And, you know, taking a 45-minute interview and boiling that down to maybe 2.5 minutes of the good stuff, editorially, I didn't have the mind for it. And it's taken years and years of sort of working with people who do it for me naturally to kind of fall into it. And up until relatively recently, I just thought you set up a microphone and contributors would just talk and tell their story. But the real art is A, finding those people and then knowing what to ask them.
Absolutely. That is the art. There is an art in that. But also, it's having that whole situation whereby you're having to make a decision because on what you use and what you don't use, because you've literally got to pack it into 26 minutes or 50 minutes or whatever it may be. And that can be awful sometimes, because you're listening to people and you're thinking, that's a really good bit they said there. And you know, there might be, you know, people do repeat themselves sometimes, but actually sometimes they repeat themselves for a reason, because they're trying to emphasize a point. And actually, if you get rid of that emphasis, it doesn't have the same meaning. You know what I mean? So there's lots of decisions that you have to make, and making sure that you know you don't misrepresent them. You want to make sure that, you know, they've got their stories going out. So yeah, it is really hard. But I think the worst thing is actually making that decision on what stays in and what comes out. You know what I mean? It's quite, and people will say, well, why do you end up doing an interview then that's an hour long and you've got to cut it down? Why don't you just make sure every interview is 15 minutes long? But as you know, people don't necessarily talk in little segments, and it takes them a while to get warmed up. And sometimes the best bit they say is right at the end, often when you've switched the microphone off, actually.
It's exactly the same in music production. It'll be typically the warm-up when you're just testing out the microphones that the band will do the best take.
Exactly. So yeah, so it's been a challenge turning those around, but that's what we do all the time. I mean, we have done, and I've done plenty, and the team's done plenty of live programming. And I sometimes think to myself, you know, it'd be great to do far much more of that, because of course, if you're doing live stuff, that's it, isn't it? You know, it's over and done with them in 1 or 2 or 3 hours or whatever it is. And if there's a mistake being made, it's a mistake being made, and all the rest of it. I think there's a tendency when you're pre-recording things to really put the effort in to make sure it sounds as good as possible. And most of what we do is built programming, you know, Radio 4, Radio 2 when it comes to their documentaries and things, and also, you know, for the World Service and other broadcasters. But coming back to the Philip thing, I feel that, I mean, I think it was great. I think the broadcasters themselves did a great service in terms of turning things around and doing and treating the story in the way it should be treated, because, you know, he's the husband of the head of state of the United Kingdom, but also of 15 other realms, and of course the Commonwealth. So huge, huge, important figure. And I don't have a problem with them giving due prominence in a way to that. But I think there comes a point in broadcasting where, and this isn't just about Prince Philip, this is about all stories really, including coronavirus and things like that. I think sometimes we should sit back a bit, or step back a bit, as broadcasters and producers and journalists and whatever, and when we're coming to making schedules and working out what goes into things or doesn't go into things, and look at the issue of sort of, are we doing the story and ourselves justice by making everything blanket for a while? Do you know what I mean? And I feel sometimes that we should pace things a bit more, and that we should think about doing specials that really stand out. And like in the instance of Prince Philip, I mean, I think it did die down for a bit, and then there was more stuff around his funeral. But I think it would have been better to have, you know, there's actually, sometimes when stories break initially, there's very little to say anyway. You know what I mean? It's quite a long time before anything actually becomes important to say. And I think the audience would like that more, I think. I think when I think back to the old days when I was growing up as a boy, you know, everybody would watch news at 10. Or the news at 5:45, or the news at 1, because they were special moments. And okay, you know, you didn't have 24/7 news channels and things like that, but there was something that I think you got from it, and I think people were more attentive in terms of taking it on board. Whereas now, I think there's so much stuff that sometimes actually the main message gets missed in a way, and you don't actually, you know, people end up switching off very, very quickly. And I think that's the same with coronavirus, in the sense that actually it's a really important story. But there have been periods over the last year whereby the media, I think, has gone overboard with it. And actually what it's meant is that it sort of made people not take it that seriously anymore. And of course, that has an effect, a serious effect, on how people react to it in the street when it comes to social distancing or wearing masks or whatever it may be. You know what I mean? So I just think, I don't know why we don't think about this. I think it would benefit us all to just to think to ourselves, well, you know, does a news bulletin or does something warrant complete 100% blanket coverage? And as I say, it happens with everything, you know, it's sort of, and then suddenly you don't hear about something for ages and ages and ages. And you think to yourself, well, what happened to such and such? Why is that suddenly not in the news or whatever anymore? You know what I mean? So that's my feeling on it. I don't know what I don't know what you think, but you know, there must be things that where you've switched off at certain times on certain stories because you've just had enough of hearing about something.
I used to be a sponge for information. I feel like I used to take everything to heart and I'd remember everything in excruciating detail. But having worked in a newsroom, having worked on speech-based radio stations where they'll talk about one particular topic for a very long time, I think I soon found that I had a very defined threshold as to how much information I could take on and keep. And even today when I'm editing, you know, hundreds of interviews, through proxy, I should be an expert now on jazz. I should be an expert on the Duke of Edinburgh, on certain aspects of Japanese culture because of the programs that I've worked on. But I'm not, because at the end of the day, you've got to preserve your own mind. You've got to do the work to the best of your ability, get it done, and then move on to the next one. I mean, just staying on the Obit theme for just a little while longer, you've experienced a few of these in your time, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I remember being in Sainsbury's doing my shopping when Queen Mother died and had to be dragged in to sort that out. I remember, who else was there? Who else died?
Diana?
Yeah, Princess Diana. I was on air and I was freelancing at that time. So I was on air in one place 1 week when she died, and then the next week when it was a funeral, I was on air doing the live link up to the Queen, you know, the Queen doing her little speech kind of thing from Buckingham Palace in the wake of her death kind of thing. And it was all tremendously exciting in a way. Covering any national or international event is big, you know what I mean? It does give you, you know, don't get me wrong, as somebody who was always interested in news and current affairs and things as a kid, and then, you know, got my dream job working in journalism, it was tremendously a privilege, really, to be able to do, to be able to cover those things. But as I've got older, I've just realised that, and I think because there's more media than ever before, I've just realised that the constant obsession with certain stories at certain times, I don't think is healthy, really, for society. You know, I just think it's just, again, it's just about balance, really. It's just about balance. News and information are constructs. So it's down to an editor, wherever it may be, to decide, actually, today we're going to cover this story and that story and whatever. But there are other things out there that, you know, what I'm saying is the news bulletins and things don't have to be full of complete doom and gloom all the time. And there are positives out there. All the things going on, you know what I mean? It's sort of, you know, a relative of mine always says, it's rough, it's dreadful out there. Oh, you know that this is, oh, this country, it's going to this, go whatever. But that again is somebody's interpretation of it. Yes, there's bad things going on, but there's plenty of good things going on as well. And you know, I just think we need to be a bit more realistic about how we communicate and how and think about what it means to people at the other side, you know what I mean? Because for a lot of people, radio and television and information they get is their lives, literally, because they, you know, they might be on their own or whatever, and they haven't got anywhere else, you know what I mean? It's sort of that they live their lives through the media. So I think it's something we need to think about, you know, going forward. I say this a lot, I've said this a lot for quite a long time to different people in the industry, and sadly I tend to be a bit of a lone voice, but I just think it's, you know, I've not got any official mental health issues in my life, but my family have, and my partner does, and you know, I do notice the impact that certain types of things have on people. And I say it's not about stopping reporting things, it's just about the balance and the amount and the way you do it, you know what I mean? And that's what I think we need to think about.
I mean, what's your coping strategy? Because I've noticed you're very unflappable. When I woke up on the morning of April 9th, I woke up to a text message, actually, from a friend who simply said Forth Bridge was down. And immediately I'd forgotten what that meant. And then when it hit me, I rolled out of bed and ran across the room to where I keep an old FM radio with an actual twisty knob for sweeping through all the frequencies, because I wanted to experience that moment and to see what it was like when all of the networks joined up, and then I caught the tail end of the national anthem. But my immediate thought after processing the news itself was, oh dear, what must we do now? Everything's gonna change. whether you're working on pre-recorded programs, whether you're working on live, God forbid if you work in scheduling. And I got myself into a bit of a tiz, even though the immediate onus was not on me at all. You, on the other hand, had to completely restructure your workforce and project deadlines and all the rest of it in order to turn things around really quickly, but it didn't seem to faze you all that much. What are your strategies for just keeping a cool head?
I mean, the flapping in a way, though, is part of the adrenaline, isn't it? You know what I mean? That is part of it. I don't really think about it, actually, in the moment. When it's something massive and you've just got to get on with it, you just have to get on with it. But you realise at the end of it how exhausted you are once it's over and done with. You know, you realise that these things do take it out of you, you know what I mean? And I don't know, it's all about trying to, again, it's all about balance, isn't it? Trying to have a bit of balance in your life. But sometimes, sadly, in broadcasting, broadcasting calls for immediate action. You've got to get on with it and do it. And I think I was always taught that you have to sometimes, you know, go above and beyond in order to achieve things. And that's always been the way, I think, all the way down the line. I mean, you know, when I was in newspapers, late teens and early 20s, often I'd have to go and report on something at a stupid hour of the day or be called out to something because there'd been some horrible thing happen, you know, and I had to go and, you know, go and talk to people where there's been some big murder or something or whatever. You know, you just get used to having to get out of your comfort zone, I suppose, in that sense. And I think, but in broadcasting terms, yeah, I mean, it's fantastic to be in those situations when you're part of a moment. I think it's brilliant. But yeah, I mean, I've seen you in action doing things. I think, you know, you cope with it, and I think you rise to the, you know, the moment. But maybe underneath you, the you know, you're like a little duck with the things flapping all the time. I don't know.
I mean, this touches on so many aspects, doesn't it, of the radio mindset. Some of us work in production. Some of us work behind the mic. Some of us do both. And it completely depends where your comfort zone is or what camp you belong in and therefore are the best equipped to deal with. I mean, when I used to work in overnight playout on some of our dearly beloved national commercial stations, I used to dream of the moment that the playout system would go up in smoke and the backup CD was nowhere to be found and I'd have to present my way out of this. But these days, I mean, I've grown up a lot. I've also gone back into my shell, and getting back into studio producing, I'm absolutely terrified of having to do something like that. But then in production situations, you know, you have to keep a cool head every day as part of your job when all things are going wrong about you. So, yeah, just depends who you are, doesn't it?
I mean, it's not easy to ad lib sometimes, is it? Let's face it. It's quite, you know, you've got to be in the mood for being able to do it. And I remember presenting various shows on radio over the years and being, I used to present an early breakfast show on one station, and it was like, it was the time of the morning when probably very few people were listening anyway, and I didn't have a producer with me or anything like that. I had to just literally go in, and it wasn't one of those things where you could just do this is that was. You had to talk, you know, there's an element of talking going on. And it can be quite hard because you end up, you start talking, you end up going down a rabbit warren where you think, oh God, how am I going to get out of that? You know what I mean?
So recently, I'm guessing you've interviewed some of the most prominent names from the world of jazz spanning the last 6 or 7 decades, going really in depth in order to get the best material out of them in order to make the 10-part series for Jazz FM. But at the same time, you're also juggling that with speaking to contributors from all over the world for a BBC World Service and 5 Live program about the day that they met Prince Philip, combining that with all the masses of interviews you do for the Distinct Nostalgia podcast. And throughout all of that, you never seem lost for words. Is that something that you've learned over the years, or were you just born that way?
I think it's something I've learned over time, really. I mean, there are lots of situations whereby, sadly, I because of what I do and I do lots of it, I can't necessarily know everything about every single thing. And therefore, you've got to be in a situation whereby you are able to help the person that you're interviewing warm to you and open up to you. And really, I suppose it's about listening to that person more than anything, because, you know, you can go into any interview with a set number of questions and things you must get out of them and all the rest of it. But actually, I find that sometimes it's better to go with the flow with a person and see how they might say something that's quite surprising and you want to know a bit more about that kind of thing. And I think it's, I mean, obviously, there are obvious things you want to know about something, but I think it's quite nice to meander occasionally. I mean, we do we do this a lot now on our podcast, Distinct Nostalgia, which Made in Manchester set up just over a year ago. And it's, you know, mainly focused on actors and writers and people from mainly old TV programmes, but also films as well, some of the great British films. And, you know, that's tremendous fun because we can go into loads of different areas. And I try and treat it more of a chat than an interview, really. I think that's quite important to do that. And you know, we get great feedback from it. And that's a great, wonderful thing to do. So, yeah, I think it's about a rapport with the person more than anything, rather than going in with all guns blazing, wanting to do a Jeremy Paxman kind of interview. And, you know, which actually I don't think works anyway, to be honest. Even in hard-headed political interviews, often they don't get the best out of somebody anyway. I'm much more of the school of David Frost, who used to do his programme on a Sunday morning, Breakfast with Frost or whatever it was, and he'd get a big leader on from a different country, Boutros Ghali or whatever, and he'd come on and say, Boutros, how the devil are you this morning? And they'd have a chat about something completely different before they got onto the topic of in hand, you know what I mean? And actually, he got far more out of them. He revealed far more than if he'd gone in and sort of been really antagonistic, you know? Mm. And I think that is, you know, a really important part of interviewing people is just making them feel comfortable. Not to catch them out, really, but to sort of make them open up to you. And that's the great thing. At the end of the day, that's also the great thing about radio, isn't it? It's an intimate medium. And, you know, I think people are more likely to open up through audio than they are through visuals sometimes, and I think that's one of the big benefits that radio has over telly.
Is that just because it's less complicated, do you think? You know, you haven't got lights, you haven't got cameras, you haven't got makeup people running around, or is it just because it's just naturally more intimate?
I think it is naturally more intimate, and still in a way, even though obviously radio listening is huge and doing very well in this country in particular, and obviously podcasts are doing quite well now as well, I think it's because it's still, in a way, slightly under the radar. I don't mean that in a negative way. I just think that people, if something appears on TV or, you know, it tends to be hyped up in some particular way, whereas radio just gets on with it and it's there, but you're not sort of... Yeah, I just think, yeah, I think people trust it more in a way. I think they trust the medium a little bit more. And yeah, you're right. I mean, people don't have to worry about what they wear or how they look and what the hair's like or whatever. And I think that helps as well, you know. Even though at the moment, of course, what's tending to happen, sadly, is that because of coronavirus and because everyone's using Zoom, there are loads of people who now you end up doing an interview with them. And even though it's radio and audio and they know it's radio and audio, they end up coming on, you know, with all the glad rags on and their, you know, the best haircuts and all the rest of it, the makeup on and all that kind of thing, because they feel as though they have to because it's visual, because they're looking at somebody often through Zoom or whatever, even though they might be recording it in a different way. I'll tell you something interesting, and I can't say who it is, but I did an interview with quite an important person during the last 6 months. And I suppose there's plenty of people who are doing this, but you don't see it. But this person was all very smart and all the rest of it, and kind of person you'd expect to be smart. And their doorbell went, and they got up, and they just literally got their boxer shorts on. That was it. And this person was a very, very senior figure. And you just think to yourself, oh, my God, you know. But, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of that going on. I'm sure there's plenty of people who just dress the top half and, you know, the rest is left to the imagination, as it were.
Yeah, well, I might have seen worse, actually, but we won't go there. I mean, sticking on the subject of seeing things in radio, and I don't feel at all qualified to even brush upon this subject, but how do you feel about visualization in radio at the moment?
I have to say it's something that I've not really warmed to. It doesn't really... Radio audio is about painting pictures in the mind at the end of the day. So when I was a kid, you know, my parents would always listen to Terry Wogan in the morning, and then at sort of mid-morning to lunchtime kind of thing, it would be Jimmy Young, who was obviously one of the forerunners to Jeremy Vine, and it was that kind of show with, you know, consumerism and the latest, you know, they'd have interviews with people and comments and same format really as Jeremy Vine is today, and always very popular. And Jimmy Young was, you know, extremely popular, and he'd been a he'd been a pop singer at one point back in the 50s, and then he'd gone into various other things. But for me, he was a radio presenter, and I always imagined him in a particular way. I always thought he was this tubby sort of guy, quite warm, quite friendly, and all the rest of it. And then when I eventually saw him, because he ended up doing a programme on Yorkshire TV that he presented with guests and whatever, and he was really thin and tall and whatever, and it completely destroyed my, not just my impression of him, but the way in which I listened to him when I did listen to him on the radio. It's I know it sounds stupid, but it did. You know, sometimes, actually, it's great to have be in a situation whereby you use your imagination. I mean, less so now, of course, because so many presenters on radio are former or existing TV presenters. So you know exactly what they look like. But certainly in the back in the day, it was very much about the voice. I mean, I remember Ken Bruce. I never thought Ken Bruce looked the way he does. I'm not saying you know, that's a good or a bad thing. Nice guy and all the rest of it. But what I'm saying is I imagined him in one particular way and he was completely different again, you know. So, and I think Steve Wright too. Steve Wright, because Steve Wright's always been a radio presenter. I always had in my mind exactly what he looked like. And of course, you know, it turned out to be something different. So I think I regret the visualization thing, really, in a way, because I think audio and TV and audio and visual is different. It's a different medium, you know.
I think, yeah, you have to want to be seen, don't you? And not everybody does.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's definitely, I mean, people often say that, you know, people have got faces for radio, don't they? And some people have got faces for radio and some people have got faces for TV. But yeah, no, absolutely. It's obviously the way things have evolved. And I think there are certain people who like to see it and want to have a look at it. But actually, largely, I don't know what you think, but largely, I think most people who are listening to the radio at any point are really only bothered about listening to the radio. I don't think they're actually that bothered about the visualization, really.
Yeah, but I don't know. To summarise this particular area, I do think that, you know, certain stations do it incredibly well. The Radio 1 visuals team gets so much engagement over Instagram, and I love all that stuff. And Radio 2 as well, especially, is finding whole new audiences through the online sphere. The strategies and techniques and technology that Global employs across most of its brands are just jaw-dropping, spellbinding. But then again, I'm not an expert on any of these things, so I shouldn't be talking about it. I just love radio visualization because I love seeing the studio and all of the kit.
Yes, I think you might be a minority in that case.
Oh, sad, but it's true.
But yes, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It is, I mean, there's a novelty of looking at it, I suppose, and thinking, oh, look what's going on there, you know. But it must be a bit of a nightmare for people who, we don't do Masters of Live Radio, but it must be a bit of a nightmare if you're a regular presenter on one of the big networks and you're constantly thinking, oh my God, somebody's looking at me here all the time. You know what I mean? It's sort of, I mean, do you really have to go into work thinking about what you look like as well as being able to broadcast properly? Perhaps you do. I mean, you tell me, because you've worked on some of the big shows and things, and you know, are the presenters as worried about what they look like or not?
Most of them just seem to have perfect hair days every day for some reason. So to wrap up then, Ashley, you know, going forward, future's looking bright for MIM. What have you got in the pipeline?
Yeah, it is looking bright. I mean, this last weekend we had 6 programmes on 5 different networks. We had the Prince Philip programmes on World Service and 5 Live. We had our Definitive History of Jazz series on Jazz FM, which is 10 parts. We had a repeat of our Radio 4 Bodies documentary series on the history of the body with Alice Roberts, Professor Alice Roberts on Radio 4. And we had an interview that I did with Jan Everington, who was the comedy writer who wrote Second Thoughts, which was on Boom Radio. And, of course, we had the start of our 3-part series, Rock and Roll Classics with Ricky Wilson. Ricky Wilson's Rock and Roll Classics on Radio 2. So a real eclectic mix of programmes there, which is fantastic. And I'm really proud that we're managing to dominate the output this last weekend on radio kind of thing. It's fantastic. And I'm sure we've got more opportunities like that coming up. And there's certainly some exciting programmes coming up. We're doing a Bob Marley programme coming up to mark the 40th anniversary of when he died in 1981. We've got some great things coming on board for Radio 4, including the return of our poetry series Tongue and Talk about dialect poets. So we've got plenty of things happening. We're hoping to get a second series of our Likely Dad's comedy, hopefully, fingers crossed. So there's plenty going on. And of course, we're also doing bits in the podcast arena as well, which is challenging. A lot of people talk about podcasting as being this great, bright future and all the rest of it, but actually you know, a lot of the time it's jammed tomorrow. It's very hard. I think it will blossom financially for people over time, and it is doing for some people. But I do think it's a much more difficult market than people have realised, really. I think there's a difference between America and here, in the sense that here we've got the BBC that, you know, you've got programming out there that you get for free. So in America, it's different because they don't have that, and therefore people are prepared to pay donations through Patreon and all those kind of things to keep things going. Whereas over here, if you're doing something that's a completely independent podcast of some kind, I think it's actually quite difficult to make it work other than being a hobby. And I think we need to think about that going forward, because there's some great ideas, there's some great things going on in the podcast market and the podcast arena. And I think we need to try and find a way of supporting it. There is talk that the BBC might sort of try and support podcasters on the outside as well as those on the inside of the BBC. So, you know, watch this space. I'd love that to happen if they can be encouraged to do it, because I think that is would be a good role for the BBC. But yeah, no, lots of things going on, lots of ideas. Hoping to branch out into some more telly. We've done TV before. We're hoping to do a bit more TV. But yeah, no, it's exciting. And yeah, we've been going 16 years in May, which is quite an achievement, I think, in terms of radio production, because as everyone's aware in radio, it's you're not guaranteed big incomes kind of thing. And, you know, but we have turned another corner recently, actually, because some of our programmes, some of our brands, as it were, are now getting interest from BBC worldwide. So they may end up going into other markets. So yeah, it's all good. It's all great progress. And we're, you know, we're certainly bigger than we were sort of 10 years ago. We have grown in that time. I just like to be in a situation, I think, over time, whereby we can make a few more things happen in terms of people's ideas, because the biggest frustration I get as a creative director of an independent production company and the team around me have is that we cannot make these ideas that people come to us with happen a lot of the time. You know, so many ideas just never get through the processes of broadcasters and whatever, and that's sometimes quite disheartening. And you know, there's some things that have taken literally 10 years to get off the ground. You know, it's like, and people, you know, people obviously are impatient. They want their ideas to work and that kind of thing. So I hope over time, one of the things I'd like to see change in the market is just more variety, more opportunities, more chances for things to be made to happen, rather than situations whereby it's the same people over and over again, or it's the same ideas kind of thing. I think, you know, we're about ideas, and I want to see people flourish through their ideas. And quite a few people who've come on board over the years have done that and have seen their ideas do really well. And I'd like to see more of that, particularly with actors and writers and, you know, people in that sphere who obviously have struggled in the last year with all the stuff to do with the theatres being, you know, not working and all that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of scope for, you know, one area I'd love to do more on is comedy. Because I think there's a massive dearth in comedy in this country in terms of, you know, good observational comedy. And I think it needs more support. And I think drama does as well. I think we've got to a point whereby, again, certain kinds of drama tend to be overkill. You know, crime dramas and hospital dramas. You know, it's all the same thing over and over again. And there's so much out there, so many ideas out there that need to be explored. And I think we've got to, as an industry as a whole, not just radio, but TV as well and film, we need to find a way of making sure we don't get drowned out by America and the streaming services. Because if we're not careful and we let them homogenise everything, then our industry could suffer. And I think it's really quite important that we sort of battle against that and make sure that British-made programming is up there. And let's face it, still does exceptionally well all around the world. So many of our brands, particularly on telly, end up in different countries and have done fantastic things. And I think we just need to cherish that a bit more, I think, as an industry, because it's very easy, as we're just seeing now in the footballing world, it's very easy for big conglomerates and big organisations and whatever to take over. And then you've destroyed your variety and choice. And I don't think that would be a good thing.
No, we've got to nurture it, haven't we? We've got to nurture our whole arts sector, really, considering what they've been through.
Exactly. And, you know, and also radio as well. You know, you're very privileged to actually be doing what you're doing. There's lots of people out there who would love to be doing what you're doing. And we need to keep the options open for people to be in that situation, you know, because let's face it, the industry has contracted in recent years. There are less and less opportunities for people to get into radio and to do what you're doing, aren't there? You know what I mean? We need to keep that open so that new generations are able to come in and realise the craft and enjoy it, you know. And you've been doing this now for a few years. I think if you were to be starting out now in the sector that we've got at the moment, because it's contracted quite a lot, you might actually be struggling to get into it. I think people who are probably starting out now to get into radio are probably finding it quite difficult, actually.
Oh, and even if you've got a so-called foothold, that could be taken away from you at any moment, especially if you're freelance. I mean, I struggled for about 5 years to get in. And even now, who knows where we'd be in a year's time? I still say, you know, almost everyone has at least a community radio station within a bus ride or a cycle ride from where they live. And if you love radio that much, then you will find a way. Just keep plugging away. The number one factor, I think, that still separates those that get in inverted commas, to those that don't, are the ones that just keep plugging away. Just be persistent. Doesn't matter if it takes you 10 years. You know, if you love it that much, you won't mind, and you'll find a way of doing radio, regardless of whether you've been given the opportunities or not, like we are doing now. I wasn't asked to guest present this episode. I asked if I could guest present an episode. It's that nerve and that gumption that gives you these little gems to play with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the industry's changed over the years, because, you know, when I was starting out it was in newspapers, but then trying to get into broadcasting, it was very easy to actually go to a commercial radio station and say to them, look, can I come in and watch what you're doing? Can I come in and make the tea? Can I come in and just help out? And over a period of time, that commercial, particularly commercial radio, they'd take you on board, because they'd see there was a benefit of having you there, because you were dedicated to it and interested in it and whatever. So, but now, of course, you've got another layer. You've got community radio, and then obviously you've got podcasts as well. So people are doing their own podcasts and not earning much at it, or, you know, trying to do it, but maybe struggling to get heard or whatever. Then you've got community radio. So, and getting into commercial radio is more difficult now, because it's become, you know, as we know, most of the stations are now sort of all merged together and all the rest of it. So there are less and less opportunities, really, to do it. And I think that's quite sad, really. And I can imagine a lot of people being put off by all that very, very quickly, you know, but we need new people to come through, not just people of your age, but older people who might be interested in radio, who've got something to give as well, because I often feel as though actually a lot of our stations could benefit from people who've had, you know, another life, the experience of life, actually, in a way.
Yeah, it's easy to get swallowed up, isn't it, by work. And I guess it's just important to remember to step away once in a while and live a little bit, so that you've got something to bring to the table.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You, at the end of the day, we're broadcasting about about lives and experiences. So we need to have a life and an experience, don't we? So, I mean, I must, you know, that's a lesson to me, really, not to work so hard. So, yeah.
Well, Ashley, it's been fascinating as always to talk to you.
Been lovely talking to you, James, and hope, you know, all the best for the future.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Ashley, for this week's edition of the podcast. Fantastic interview. Great insights. Now, before we close for a while, it's a bit of information about CleanFeed, because CleanFeed is designed for radio and podcasters, whether you're doing an OB, interview, or co-hosting. It's simple to connect live audio over the web. The quality is great, and you can record as well. CleanFeed doesn't cost anything to get started, and you can find out more at cleanfeed.net. Thank you very much for being part of the Radio Today program. We're going to take a break for a while, but hopefully we'll be back at some point in the future. Till then, stay safe.
The Radio Today program with Broadcast Bionics.
Original music for this podcast was composed by Macassar.